Winston Churchill's private secretary, John Jock Colville, was dozing lightly when his telephone rang at 4 a.m. on Sunday, June 22. It was the Foreign Office, calling with sensational news. Thousands of Wehrmacht soldiers were pouring across the Soviet frontier, a clear sign that Hitler's long-expected invasion of the Soviet Union had begun. Colville was under strict instructions not to wake the Prime Minister unless the British Isles itself was under attack. He therefore waited a couple of hours before knocking on Churchill's bedroom door. The PM's first reaction was a smile of satisfaction, for this was the best possible news. Hitler was now fighting a war on two fronts. He then took a snap decision.
Tell the BBC I will broadcast at 9 tonight.
Finally, although it was still early, he reached for a celebratory cigar. Life had just changed for the better. Welcome to episode 94 of Beyond Barbarossa, The Impossible Alliance, Part 1. Beyond Barbarossa is the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting, as always, from the Redbeard Studio on the unceded territory of the Anishinaabeg Algonquin people, also called Ottawa, in free, sovereign, independent Canada. If you hear some unusual background noise in this episode, it may be the furnace. As I record, the temperature in Ottawa is minus 30 Celsius, including a mild north wind chill. The sky is completely clear, a gorgeous blue, and the fresh snow glares bright white over everything. It's cold enough that tires squeak as cars roll past my house. So, no, I'm not turning off the furnace during recording, just to avoid a bit of fan noise. Last episode described the Yalta Conference, the second summit meeting of the big three Allied leaders of the Second World War, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, U.K. Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and Premier Joseph Stalin. We looked at how the meeting happened, how the three leaders got to Yalta in the Crimean Peninsula, and the decisions they came to. But that overview left a lot of questions, for me too, such as, why were the decisions announced at the end of the summit so vague? Why was there a rift between Roosevelt and Churchill? And the big question, Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States, why did he behave so naively when it came to dealing with Joseph Stalin? To help answer that, I'm joined, virtually, by Giles Milton, million-copy author of several books, and a podcaster as well, to talk about his newest book and a major source of that last episode, The Stalin Affair, The Impossible Alliance That Won the War. That book describes the relationship between the top three leaders of the Second World War. But the book goes beyond those three, describing an alliance that hinged on other relationships among people. Well, here's the official blurb. The Stalin Affair, the remarkable true story of the motley group of Allied men and women who worked to manage Stalin's mercurial, explosive approach to diplomacy during four turbulent years of World War II. In the summer of 1941, Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, shattering what Stalin had considered an ironclad partnership. There were real fears that Stalin's forces would be defeated or that the Soviet leader would once again strike a deal with Hitler. either eventuality would spell catastrophe for both Britain and the United States. Enter W. Averill Harriman, a railroad magnate and, at the start of the war, the fourth richest man in America. At Roosevelt's behest, he traveled to Britain to serve as a liaison between the president and Churchill and to spearhead what became known as the Harriman Mission. Together with his fashionable young daughter, Kathy, an unforgettable cast of British diplomats, and Churchill himself, he would eventually manage to wrangle Stalin into the partnership the Allies needed to defeat Hitler. That's what an editor at a publishing company thought. I found this book to be very different from other histories of the Second World War. It's driven by personalities, focusing on what the blurb describes as motley, which means a varied character. And they were motley, from the national leaders to Averill Harriman to Vyacheslav Molotov to Sarah Churchill to Kathy Harriman and more. Well, motley is a mild descriptor. For the best description of what the Stalin affair is about, let's turn to the author himself, Giles Milton. Welcome, Giles. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we'll get right into the story of this book. It was a very different kind of history than I've read before, because it was very much focused on the people and the personalities. You know, there are lots of facts and figures in it, and lots of dates and the actual events, but very much a focus. It's through the lens of the relationships that led to the, or were knitted into that alliance between the big three, the United States, United Kingdom, and Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And it's the topic of the previous episode of Beyond Barbarossa. So for the listeners, can you give the listeners a 1 to 2 sentence, or maybe a little bit more, summary? What is the book about?
Yeah, so the at the heart of the book is the alliance between the West, that's America, and Canada and Great Britain, and the Soviet Union. And this was the most unlikely alliance, you could imagine. I mean, Churchill had personally hated Stalin for his entire political career and detested the Soviet Union and everything it stood for. But, you know, this was a question of pragmatism. It's the old phrase, my enemy's enemy is my friend. Hitler was attacking both the Soviet Union and Great Britain, and that effectively put them into the same camp. And so you have this completely bizarre kind of relationship taking place between Stalin and his oldest enemy, political foe, Joseph Stalin. And you're going to see many contortions and many weird things happening over the course of the war as these very, very improbable allies effectively get into bed together.
Right.
And what I wanted to do is tell it from the people working behind the scenes, because I discovered that there was a wealth of archival material, diaries, letters, all sorts of things from people immediately, the entourage around Churchill, the entourage around Stalin. And if you like, that it's almost like history from peeking out behind the curtains. You know, you feel that hopefully when you read my book, you feel that you're eavesdropping on these private conversations taking place, well, often between Churchill and Stalin, or between Roosevelt and Stalin.
Right.
So it's a unique perspective that I've never read of before.
Right. Yeah. I think I was really brought into it. The letters from, for example, Archie Clark Kerr, from Kathleen Harriman, the notes passed between Averill Harriman and others, and comment that Churchill made to his doctor, for example, that got picked up by Stalin. I think that was quite an episode. So the subtitle of the book is The Impossible Alliance That Won the War. And it focuses very much on these relationships between people. So what do you think was the most important relationship that had the biggest influence on the development of that alliance, that led to that alliance?
Well, I think one of the most extraordinary things that happened is on the day that the Hitler's army, the Wehrmacht, rolled over the border into the Soviet Union, news was brought that night to Winston Churchill of what had happened. And Churchill really had to make a big, possibly one of the biggest political decisions of his entire career, which mm-hmm. is, does he throw his support behind the Soviet Union, which is a country he's been, you know, bad-mouthing for the better part of 20 years, or does he abandon them to his own fate? And he has this meeting. He's, you know, to picture the scene, he's in his country house, which is called Chequers, which is just mm-hmm. outside London. He's there with all his most senior advisors, all the most senior politicians in the country. And they're all saying, you simply can't forge an alliance with Joseph Stalin. I mean, this is absurd. You know, you've been telling the British public what a monster he is for decades. And mm-hmm. now you're really proposing to go to his rescue. But Churchill, and I think this is one of the aspects, you know, it shows his political bravery, is that he decides, no, he is going to support Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union because, of course, it's in Britain's best interests. And that night, from Chequers, he delivers an address to the nation through the BBC, a live broadcast. And it's a brave broadcast. And he's very, very honest with the British public. He said, look, no one has been more hostile towards Stalin than me. No one has despised the Soviet system more than me. But this is our hour of great need, he says. Mm-hmm. And if we can support the Soviet Union in any way we can, that's basically, that's going to be good news for Great Britain. And so there is a very large dose of pragmatism going on mm-hmm. here. From Churchill's point of view, this is in Britain's best interest.
What's interesting to me about that is that he made that decision so quickly, like almost on the spot. He gets the phone call that the Wehrmacht has rolled into the USSR, and he says pretty much right away, okay, we're going to take their side, or we're going to invite them, and we're going to support Stalin in any way we can.
He does, indeed. Indeed, the very first thing he does is light a celebratory cigar. This is at 6 in the morning when he's brought the news. He lights a cigar because this, for Winston Churchill, I think, is the best possible news. You've got to remember that Britain is in a desperate situation mm-hmm. in the summer, by the spring, summer of 1941. The Luftwaffe are bombing its cities. They're destroying infrastructure. Britain's really suffering. We have a lack of munitions here. We have a lack of food here, and we're reliant on getting stuff from the United States because, mm-hmm. of course, by this stage, the famous Lend-Lease program has kicked in, bringing supplies over to Great Britain. But Great Britain is on its knees, and Churchill is constantly writing letters to Roosevelt, really begging for support. So when Churchill, on the 22nd of June 1941, is brought news that Hitler's attacked the Soviet Union, this is fantastic news from his point of view, because it means that Hitler is now fighting a war on two fronts. Mm-hmm. And he knows that that could make it very, very dangerous for Adolf Hitler.
So you would say then that is the crucial relationship between Churchill and Stalin.
Yeah, it's a crucial, at this point it's crucial. Mm-hmm. What's fascinating and becomes really apparent from when you read the original source material is that neither Churchill nor any of his advisors know anything about Joseph Stalin. Mm-hmm. Joseph Stalin is a complete enigma. You know, he hasn't been seen in public in the Soviet Union for the better part of 3 years. He never makes speeches to the mm-hmm. nation. They know nothing about him. The British ambassador in Moscow has never met Joseph Stalin.
Yes.
So they know nothing about him. And this is sort of one of Churchill's first things he says, is like, we're going to the support of this person, this leader, this mm-hmm. dictator, and yet we know nothing about him, apart from the fact that he's a monstrous dictator who's liquidated millions of his own people.
Right.
And so one of the first tasks of Churchill is to send somebody out to the Soviet Union and just try and find out more about him.
It was with that Stafford Cripps, Sir Stafford Cripps?
Stafford Cripps was the British ambassador in Moscow. Now, mm-hmm. the British had sent, he was quite left-wing, he was a socialist, old-fashioned socialist, and they'd sent him out there with the idea that, you know, surely someone very left-wing would be able to mm-hmm. forge a relationship with Joseph Stalin. In fact, Joseph Stalin detested Stafford Cripps, refused ever to see him. And actually, as Churchill pointed out when he became prime minister, he says these people like, these communists like Joseph Stalin, what they really admire is an old-fashioned British aristocrat, which, of course, wow. Churchill himself was. And he, one of the first things that Churchill will do is sack Sir Stafford Cripps and bring in a new ambassador who he thinks is going to be able to forge a close personal relationship with Stalin. This is absolutely crucial to the alliance, that he needs someone on the ground in Moscow who can quite literally get on with Stalin.
Who from the UK could possibly get on with Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin? We'll find out after this short break.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more on my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
As Scott elegantly describes in each episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the war on the Eastern Front was truly gargantuan, both in terms of its geography and its destructiveness. But given that there is so much territory to cover, and that so many millions of men were involved in the fighting, it's perhaps inevitable that some battles from the Eastern Front get overlooked. I'm David Sumner, and I'm the host of Europe at War, a weekly podcast exploring lesser-known battles and stories of the Second World War, with a particular focus on the Eastern Front. From the drama of thousands of trapped German soldiers and terrified civilians attempting to break out of the Hauba pocket, to the unexpected and blistering counterattack launched by German forces on the Red Army during the Battle of Bautzen, many of the Eastern Front's most dramatic battles, particularly those which happened towards the end of the war, have long been neglected by historians, and their stories have remained untold. Until now. So to hear these incredible tales from the Eastern Front and more, check out Europe at War, available on all podcast platforms. Thank you. Now let's get back to the show.
Welcome to part 2 of episode 94 of Beyond Barbarossa, The Impossible Alliance. We're joined by Giles Milton, author of The Stalin Affair, The Impossible Alliance That Won the War. Before the break, we learned that Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin detested the British ambassador in Moscow in June 1941. Sir Stafford Cripps. Cripps never once got to meet the man in charge of the USSR during his entire tenure as ambassador, which lasted from May 1940 to January 1942. Despite trying repeatedly and very hard. As author Giles Milton explained in 1941, the United Kingdom needed a representative, an ambassador, who could get on with Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. But Who could do that? Giles?
So this is going to be Archie Clark Kerr.
Right.
Now, I have to say, he's one of the favourite characters in my book, and one of the favourite characters I think I've ever come across. Archie Clark Kerr, for those who will not be familiar with him, he was, as you say, he was the British ambassador in Moscow. But if you think of a British ambassador in the 1940s, you know, they wear pinstripe suits, they carry rolled umbrellas, they have black briefcases and bowler hats, you know, they went to Eton, they went to Oxford. Archie is completely different from this. He doesn't want anyone to call him Your Excellency. Everyone calls him Archie. He walks around the embassy and the embassy gardens in a pair of shorts and nothing else. He writes his memos with a quill pen. He's totally eccentric, which requires him to have a flock of geese in the British Embassy in Moscow. And so when he needs a new quill, he just pulls out a feather. And he's flamboyant, he's eccentric, he's a maverick, and he's bisexual, which is extremely unusual to send a maverick bisexual to go and befriend Joseph Stalin.
Right.
He has two things in his favour. First, he's extremely likeable and gregarious.
I loved him. I thought he was...
Yes, yeah. No, he's brilliant.
I liked myself.
Absolutely brilliant. The second thing is, like Stalin, he is a fanatical pipe smoker. And when they first have their first meeting, they bond over the merits of smoking a pipe. And so this Archie Clark Kerr, who really, he's going to become one of the most important people during the war in Moscow. In fact, he's going to become the linchpin of the relationship between Churchill and Stalin. And as readers will see in the book, he really is going to hold this always precarious alliance together, because frankly, there are many, many points during the war when this alliance almost falls apart, you know, especially when Churchill himself travels to Moscow. And, you know, where we can go into that maybe a bit later, but it's a very, very tense relationship, and it requires all the human skill, the diplomatic ability of Archie Clark Kerr to keep this relationship on track.
Yes, and there are several instances in the book describing that where, you know, Churchill would lose his temper, or at least in private lose his temper, threaten to leave and to walk out, and it was very closely averted, and the relationship held together just by Ed Clark Kerr, and as well as others in the diplomatic service. So, yeah, given that Stalin was such an enigma, and he largely remains to be, I think there's been a lot of ink devoted to his story and his background and so on, but he still seems, to me anyway, quite a contradictory character in some ways. When you were doing the research and you were going into the original source material, what surprised you that you learned about Stalin?
Okay, so well, this is where the story really got fascinating, because I think Churchill and most other people in Great Britain, when they thought of Joseph Stalin, indeed most people even today, when they think of Joseph Stalin, they think dictator, mass murderer, thoroughly unpleasant individual. And all of those things he most certainly was. But what my team in Moscow, both British and American, who got to know Stalin very, very intimately, you know, these guys were in and out of the Kremlin every day. Mm. They met him all the time. And they discovered that there was a different Stalin. And it was a Stalin that they were constantly urging their governments back at home to beware of. Because they said, yes, he's a monster. Yes, he's a murderous dictator. But he's also extremely shrewd. He's a brilliant negotiator. Mm-hmm. He's extremely well informed. He's brilliantly well read. And as would become apparent as the war went on, he could run rings around Churchill and Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And honestly, my guys on the ground in Moscow, they were absolutely astonished, because they had no idea that Joseph Stalin, look, this is a man who's almost never left the Soviet Union. And yet he was so knowledgeable about other countries, you know, about the outside world. So at one point he gives President Roosevelt a lecture on the caste system in India, you know, and not only that, he was a brilliant negotiator. He was so shrewd and so artful. And so my team in Moscow were really, their memos back to Washington and to Whitehall in London were just constantly saying, do not underestimate this guy. Of course he's a monster. But he's a very, very clever monster, and you ignore that at your peril, you know.
That's in the negotiations at Yalta, for example, but also throughout the term of the war, it struck me that he had a different conception of what negotiating meant than, say, Churchill and Roosevelt, where Churchill and Roosevelt, we in the West, negotiation, okay, we'll give up a little bit, you give up a little bit. But it seems to me that the Soviets never gave up anything.
No. And look, you only have to look at the Yalta Conference. I mean, you know, Roosevelt comes with a great army of advisors and helpers, and so does Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's got 700, Stalin, you said.
So, yeah, it's hundreds and hundreds. And then you've got Stalin. He's just there with Molotov, his foreign commissar. You know, Stalin is a dictator. He doesn't need advice from anyone. He takes the decisions, and that's what happens. But here's an example of how skillful he was, that he was able to adapt his language according to who he was speaking to. So when he was speaking to his own people, Soviets, Russians, you know, he'd be utterly blunt. He'd say, I want this done now. And it was, there was no, to be no debate. Mm-hmm. And the interpreters were fascinated. The American and British interpreters were so interested because they noticed that when Stalin talked with Churchill's team or with Roosevelt's team, he completely changed his language. And he would sort of say things like, would it not be better if perhaps we tried this? You know, so he mimicked this, the language used by the British, you know, contingent there to sound, you know, totally reasonable and, you know, open to suggestions and everything, which of course he wasn't. He had his absolutely fixed views, but he was, that was what I think my guys realized, that this is a very, very devious manipulator here. And he's clever because he knows how to do it and how to pull it off. And that's why they were so alarmed when they saw Roosevelt particularly, but Churchill as well, taking what Stalin said at face value. They said, oh, you've got to be really, really careful when dealing with this guy.
Yeah, let's jump right to that. I think the best example of this is the story or the question of Poland, right? Yeah. Where especially Churchill had a goal. He wanted a free and independent and robust Poland, and Stalin obviously did not. He wanted Poland under Soviet control, under his control. How is it that the Western leaders would go in and be prepared to make some concessions, and seeing that Stalin wasn't?
They didn't dig
in their heels too.
Yeah, Poland was one of the great issues at the Yalta Conference, of course, and you know, it's worth reminding your listeners that for Great Britain, Great Britain went to war over Poland. You know, we declared war on Nazi Germany when Germany invaded Poland. So Poland was absolutely at the top of Churchill's agenda. And what Churchill wanted at the end of the war was a democratic Poland.
Right.
Remember, London had been hosting the Polish government in exile for the entire course of the war.
Right.
What's Stalin do? He sets up a rival government of Polish communists in Moscow, and he wants them to go into Poland at the end of the war. So you have two very, very different opposing points of view about what happens to Poland. And here's an example of Stalin's mastery of language. Now, Churchill delivers these incredibly lofty monologues, you know, full of great phrases and everything. And at one point he turns to Stalin and he says, Mr. Stalin, you know, for me and for Great Britain, the fate of Poland is a matter of honor.
Mm-hmm.
Stalin, quick as a flash, retorts to Winston Churchill. He said, if Poland is a matter of honor for Mr. Churchill, it is a matter of life and death for the Soviet Union.
Right.
And again, it's just quite a clever way that Stalin twists this rather lofty phrase from Churchill on its head and scores a very good point off him, you know. Stalin certainly, by the time of the Yalta Conference, had zero intention of letting Poland have a democratic government.
Mm-hmm.
It was his intention to have a government that essentially was controlled from Moscow. It's going to be formed of Polish communists who did everything that he, Joseph Stalin, wanted them to do.
And that's ultimately what he got, isn't it?
That's ultimately what he got. In fact, I mean, look at the Yalta Conference. Joseph Stalin pretty much got everything he wanted. You know, by the time of the conference, so we're of course talking of February 1945, by the time of that conference, the Red Army was already controlling most of Eastern Europe and Central Europe and Poland and moving into Germany.
Right.
So Stalin, effectively, he kind of already got what he wanted, you know, and the Baltic states, of course, you know. Mm-hmm. So Churchill and Roosevelt were on very much on the back foot mm-hmm. by Yalta, because Stalin was in possession of everything, all the territories he coveted.
Yeah, that's true. And I'll just make this point quickly. It kind of puts the situation currently in Ukraine in Poland's place in 1945, where Putin doesn't want a democratically elected government in Ukraine, but wants a government that is answerable to him. We're going to keep focused on the Second World War in 1945.
Yeah, yeah, but you're right. I mean, there are striking similarities yeah. between Ukraine now and Poland then, yes.
Now, the relationship that we haven't really touched on is Roosevelt's and his approach. Your book suggests that his attitude towards Stalin was naive, and many others thought so at the time, including his closest aides. I know that he was quite ill at the time. Maybe that affected his judgment. It seemed to affect his speech. But did Roosevelt really believe he could bring Stalin around to his point of view? What did he base that assumption on? That's a big question, a historic question. And unfortunately, we're out of time to answer it in this episode. Listeners, Giles Milton will give us his answer to those questions in the next episode. So join us in 1 week for part 2 of The Impossible Alliance with author Giles Milton. Yes, I said 1 week, not 2. Consider it a winter bonus. Until then, thank you for listening to The Impossible Alliance Part 1, Episode 94 of Beyond Barbarossa. Please take a second to give it a rating on whichever podcasting app you're listening on. If you have a few minutes, please consider giving it a review. Doing that helps others who are interested in this part of history to find the podcast. You can also help me keep Beyond Barbarossa going by supporting on Patreon. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to every episode, plus occasional bonus episodes. Until it's safe for all Ukrainian refugees to return home, proceeds go to charities that help support them. Go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and choose whatever level of support you prefer. Do you have a question, a comment, something to add or to correct? I'd love to hear from you. You can email me, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or leave your thoughts on the Beyond Barbarossa Facebook page. You can also find me, Scott Burry, author, on Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads, and other social media. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next week, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina! Vive le Canada!